Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
So would you say that that's kind of like the lightning bolt moment for
you? And that's
why
I taught myself how to draw, was actually the Little Mermaid, drawing stills of Ariel.
I've got better things to do tonight than die.
Sylvester jumped out of his chair and said, who the F is this?
I remember walking out of the theater with him saying, I'm going to write Halloween.
I'm rather impressed with your research. Rarely do people ask me about Children in the Corn.
It doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. You know, throw some spaghetti against a wall. See if it sticks.
This is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward. Welcome back to Excelsior Journeys, the road to creativity. This is George Soroy, and thank you so much for being here. And for those of you who have listened to this show, that there are two different angles that really play a part in making the show what it is. One is featuring various authors in different types, those that have done work in all these wonderful different genres. And there are also those that have played a part in my own inspiration, my own motivation, and the development of my life, you can say. And I'm thrilled to say that this time around for this week's episode, we have both of those types of guests combined into one. Art Bell is currently enjoying the release of his thriller, What She's Hiding. But at the same time, he also is bringing a whole lot of history with him as someone who was not only the former president of Court TV, but is also the man responsible for so many of us enjoying what is known as Comedy Central. The man is the one who actually got it going. And I am so excited to talk about both elements, about the writing and about the development of this wonderful channel. And I also need to note that he has also released a memoir about doing this called Constant Comedy, How I Started Comedy Central and Lost My Sense of Humor. And that was actually an award-winning finalist in the 2020 Book Awards. So we're going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about the channel. We're going to be talking about the thriller, What She's Hiding. There's a whole lot here to discuss, and I'm really, really excited to have Art here. So it is my pleasure to introduce my guest this week, Art Bell. Art, how are you, sir?
I'm good, George. Thanks for having me.
And thank you so much for reaching out. I am just, it's an honor for me to have you on here. It's not every day that I have someone here who is directly responsible for so much of my own entertainment and enjoyment during my high school years. So thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we go into the history and everything, I would really love to hear about What She's Hiding, because it sounds like it's a really interesting pivot from everything that you've done.
Yeah, it is an interesting pivot. I didn't start writing seriously until I'd left the television business and was trying to decide what to do next. My career has been interesting in that I've done many different things. I started out actually as an economist in Washington, D.C. It's a little bit different to start as an economist and end up going through the television business and then becoming a writer. So I always wanted to be in the television business. So after my few years in Washington as an economist, I went back to business school and came out and said, I'm going to work in the TV business. And what I really wanted to do was work at a comedy channel, but there wasn't one. And so that was a challenge for me. And then I finished up with the TV business and started writing. The first thing I wrote was memoir. Mm-hmm. And I encourage anybody out there who's interested in writing at all to start with memoir. It's a good place to start because the stories, you're not making up the stories, they're there. And that was really helpful to me. And I did end up writing about Comedy Central because I had only about 1 million stories that I've been telling for years. I left Comedy Central in the mid to late 90s. And then I went on to Court TV and some other things. And so I had been telling these stories for 10 or 15 years to my kids and to everybody else. And they were easy. They were accessible. And the fact that I had told them over and over means I didn't lose them. It's not like I was keeping a journal. People say, wow, you've got a lot of information and a lot of detail in your memoir on Comedy Central. How'd you do that? And I said, well, you tell the stories over and over, or they just become part of you. So that was that. And talk about pivots. A lot of people find it an interesting pivot to go from memoir to fiction. Because they are very different genres, as you can imagine. As I said, with memoir, you are accessing stories that actually happened. With fiction, it's all coming from you. It's all made up. I know some authors lean on experiences in their lives. I guess we all do in some sense. because we're drawing on all of our experiences to make up these stories. Mm-hmm. But this is not a story about me or anything that happened about me. What she's hiding is really started as a short story. I wanted to write a story about somebody who faced violence for the first time, because so many of us, we read about violence, we hear about violence. I mean, I'm talking about real life, death-defying, mortal danger.
Yeah.
But hopefully most of us don't experience that. But I read an essay when I was in high school about a writer who walked into a bar and wasn't a violent guy, but got into a fight that he really didn't want to get into. Yeah. And the essay was called The Violence That Finds You. And I was fascinated with that, that sometimes we get into violent situations. So what she's hiding, it's about a guy. He's a lawyer in New York. He gets into a really, really bad situation, really bad trouble through no fault of his own. His ex-wife gets him into it. And I wanted to see what would happen, how he would get out of it. So I kept writing.
That's great. It almost sounds kind of like the way that Larry Cohen would write when he was, how he would come up with like a scene that really grabbed his attention and then figure out what happened afterwards and what happened before. So
that's exactly it. I started with a scene, but not only a scene, a character.
Yeah.
A guy. And I really thought I would see what happened to him, how he handled it.
Nice. Yeah. That's really cool. That's such a cool way of doing it. Just kind of dropping him into a situation, just like, okay, dance. Let's go. Let's see what happens.
Right. Exactly right. And other writer, I thought it was kind of a crazy way to write a novel, but it turns out probably half the novelists out there do exactly the same thing. When I'm talking about the guys who are bestsellers and have been writing books and books and books, it's a very interesting way to write.
And I do have to say that, just to touch briefly, when you mentioned how you were in economics first, and then you got into writing and being executive and everything, it sounds like that is a reason why a lot of people that have business backgrounds and things that may come off as very boring, but then they go into film or television and everything. And it's because of that background. It's like creating almost like a foundation, something that they can build upon. And it's something that I think that a lot of people need to remember, that like sometimes it's one thing to have that passion and then continue to focus on that. But if you don't have like any sort of like a actual like foundation, something like business or economics or something like that, then you have like something that can get blown over very quickly because you don't know like all the business stuff that goes with it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, listen, writing a novel is about, as I said, drawing on your experiences. You can't, like, it's very hard to write a novel if you've lived in your room all your life. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really have to know what's going on. First and foremost, you have to know about people.
Yeah.
And secondly, you have to know about how different kinds of arenas, jobs. I wasn't a lawyer, but I knew a lot of lawyers and talked to them a lot about what it was like at a law firm. And, but it's interesting to think about the fact that we all grew up. We all had childhoods. Those weren't jobs so much, but we all did a lot of the same things that were very creative and very observant, I would say. You have to really start to plug into the world from the time you're probably 3 or 4 or 5 years old, certainly when you start going to school and start understanding, hey, how does this work? I'm a kid. There's other kids. There's a teacher. There's a principal. He's a scary mother. I mean, you're starting to evaluate the world around you and start to have opinions about what that is. And then, listen, all the playing that we do, that's what feeds our creativity ultimately. Let's make it up.
That's a great way to look at it, too. And so do you have like other writing projects as well? How has it been like kind of getting into this genre? Was it a good experience for you? Something you'd want to continue on?
Well, truthfully, I've loved this genre since I was reading. I mean, I read, and let's define the genre as mystery thriller. And then there's some sort of subgenres that I really spent a lot of time exploring. I started reading Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes, and I read all of them when probably around the time I was in 8th or 9th grade. Fascinating. Then I started reading noir, the classic noir, Dash Hammett and those guys. And man, I found that fascinating because they built a world. I mean, not unlike science fiction writers, they built a world that essentially didn't exist. I mean, this kind of dark, and I mean literally and figuratively, but just mean-spirited, full of double crossers and grifters and liars and and ultimately women good and bad, women that were in love with they shouldn't have been. I mean, the whole world that these original noir writers and then, of course, translated into the movies that, that came from them. But that whole world was so fascinating to me that when I sat down to write What She's Hiding, I wanted to do that. I wanted to bring that worldview into my novel. Now, my novel takes place in modern current times.
Right.
So it's not like a 1940s thing, but it does have elements of noir in it that I adopted.
That's something that we don't see as much anymore. Like usually all like the noir stuff and the really good, like all the good, like detective kind of thrillers, like they're all based out of times like Chinatown, that showing that one as so many years ago. And so hearing about like a modern noir thriller, that sounds really cool. That sounds
I called it noirish after I was done because it's not deep noir, but so many people commented on it. Man, this is like a noir thing. This is really cool because it's noir for modern times. And I'll tell you, one of the things that I was fascinated by was how do you depict femme fatale, kind of tough women, in a modern setting? I mean, in the 40s,
the bombshell.
I mean, it was really stuff you couldn't get away with today in terms of how women were described and treated and what they said and what all that kind of stuff. Although, one of the things I took from noir was that those women were pretty capable, even the good ones and the bad ones. They were self-sufficient. And I liked that about them. And I certainly that built that in. There's three strong women characters in the novel, and all different, but all kind of interesting women and all likable in some sense, even though one of them's not such a good person.
Mm-hmm. And I just thinking about this and seeing how it could possibly translate to a big screen, because everyone wants that. Everyone wants to see their own work going beyond the pages and seeing where it takes them. But I can see this almost like even though a modern noir film, but in black and white.
Listen, it's been interesting to watch what's been made lately in black and white. The Talented Mr. Ripley, which I think they called Mr. Ripley on the Netflix series. I don't know.
Ripley.
Fabulous. And also the cinematography on that was just a wonder to behold. And it was in black and white. And I just, when it first popped on the screen, I went, wow, they're really going to do this in black and white. And man, they nailed it. They really did.
Yeah. And it seems like this is the time where a lot of people are taking chances, different things like this, different streaming channels. They're trying all different types of formats, different types of storytelling. It could either be episodic or it could be just one long going episode, and so many different ways to try it. So this would be a good time to see that kind of story get brought somewhere.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly all for it.
There you go.
If there's any producers in your audience who are interested.
And you're definitely no stranger to taking chances, because several decades before, this was when you decided you were going to roll the dice on a comedy channel. And what brought that about?
Well, that really started with my love of comedy, which began at a very early age. I mean, I'm talking about 6 or 7 or 8 when I started noticing that making people laugh was a pretty powerful superpower. And I remember watching, there was a show called the Ed Sullivan Show. I mean, that was a long time ago, but that was Sunday night at 8 o'clock. The entire country was watching. I mean, you're talking about 30 million households tuning in at the same time. And I saw Richard Pryor in his first appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Wow.
And he was so funny. And my father was cracking up, and my kid brother was cracking up, and the audience at the Ed Sullivan Theater was cracking up. And then I realized that like 50 or 60 million people were laughing at the same time. I mean, how powerful is that? How powerful is that to get that kind of emotional response from that many people at once? And I just said, man, this comedy thing is really cool. And that's when I got interested.
Yeah, I've been a stand-up comedy fan for as long as I could remember. I remember just like being like 6 years old and hearing my first taste of George Carlin. Some of his material really grabbed my attention. And then a couple years later, that's when Bill Cosby himself premiered on HBO. That just really grabbed my attention. And I was as many people were. Like, I was Bill Cosby fan growing up from those stand-up days, and my father found a whole bunch of his old records and everything, and I was playing them and, you know, really got into that whole stand-up feeling. So just seeing that there was going to be a channel that catered to that and really featured a lot of it, because I mean, it's just a great way to bring in a lot of content at once, wouldn't you say?
You're absolutely right. And I went through the same indoctrination as you did, although at a different time, a different decade. Those albums you just mentioned were new when I was in fifth or sixth or seventh grade. And we must have really played the crap out of those George Carlin and Bill Cosby albums. We just had them on all the time in the house.
Yeah.
And we started talking like those guys, my brothers and I, which confounded my parents, as you can imagine. But
I actually did a lot of those routines, a lot of the Cosby routines for my grandmother. She always wanted me to just go ahead and recite them and everything. And there were times when it was always fun.
That was the best part. And anyway, so yeah, we were indoctrinated the same way from the same material at different times. But the point is, by the time I got into high school, I was really interested in pursuing comedy in some way. And I started writing some funny stuff, satire mostly, and trying to do it a little bit of performance, not a whole lot, not stand up. I was not the kind of guy who wanted to do stand up, but I did a bunch of sketch comedy in college and, again, some more writing. In grad school, we put on a show called The Follies, and it was a takeoff on what was going on in business school. And it was, I was the head writer for the second year. And I just thought, man, I really kind of can do this if I wanted, but I didn't want to do that. I wanted to work in the television business. I didn't want to be a writer. Yeah. And as I said, when I came out of school, I wanted to work at a comedy network, but there wasn't one. And it was at the time when the MTV had started and CNN had started, all news channel, and A&E had just started, all sports channel, ESPN showed up. And I'm thinking, okay, all these channels are showing up. Where's the comedy channel? I don't get it. Why is that not here? Anyway, so sort of put together a way to do it in my mind, and then started. My first job was at CBS. Nobody was there. There was interested because cable, that was not their thing, and it was going to be a cable channel. But luckily, I got a job at HBO, and I started pitching HBO about, we really should do a comedy channel. I mean, you guys are doing great comedy. You're doing, as you pointed out, Carlin and Klein and Cosby and all these guys, and taking chances with Sam Kinison and all those guys. You guys are comedy. And I said, and by the way, if you look over your shoulder, A&E, Evening at the Improv, and I don't know if you remember that show. And I said, these guys are creeping up on you, and they're getting an audience, and you don't want to be not known for comedy in favor of these guys at A&E. And they said, we don't care. The first time I pitched a comedy network, they were just like, no, we're not going to do that. Nobody's going to do it. It's too expensive. You can't. The production costs are ridiculous. Talent, you'll never get the talent. They just went on and on. And I did have one meeting with the head of programming at HBO. I mean, I was just a kid then. These people were like levels and levels above me, but I put myself together and I said, I'm going to pitch this. And I went in and pitched this, and she spent 15 minutes just telling me why it would never work. That was a little disappointing, but I didn't give up. I didn't give up.
I'm so glad you didn't. And I'm sure that there are a lot of comics that are really glad you didn't, because what you provided by doing this is you provided a platform for so many other people that otherwise would not have gotten it, because they had plenty of on HBO. They had the HBO Comedy Hours. They had the HBO On Location. They had the Half Hour, the HBO One Night Stand, and even Def Comedy Jam. So they had some platforms, some places for up and comers, but getting a channel like this and with opening up so much space, you have to fill it. So why not make new stars along the way?
Yeah, George, you've hit on a lot of things there. One of the unexpected, slightly unexpected results of putting the comedy channel, it was originally called the Comedy Channel, on the air was we attracted all the comedians. I mean, all the comedy writers. I mean, they were so flattered that someone had said, what you guys do is important enough to devote an entire channel to. And they started hanging out and they started calling us. I mean, I assumed some of that would happen, but you never know.
Right.
But man, when they started hanging out and they started saying, comics never really say thank you, but you know, you get the feeling that you've done something right for the business. And that was a great outcome of putting the Comedy Channel together.
It sounds like a lot of the people were really coming to you and pitching.
Listen, the industry doesn't work that way. You have to assume that you're going to start something and mm-hmm. you're going to get, if you're really good and you really can become the center of the comedy universe. And by the way, that's what we used to say. We want to be the center of the comedy universe. If you do that, then people will bring their best stuff to you. And people who can't get a meeting anywhere else mm-hmm. will show up at the door with fantastic stuff. And MST, Mystery Science Theater 3000, that's the whole story behind that. They showed up and really right at the beginning saying, is this something you would be interested in? And we fell off our chairs. We were so, so excited about it.
That's wonderful. And talk about a home run right there. Like, did you see like that that was going to be like the centerpiece basically like of the channel?
Well, again, yeah, I never forecast the future because it's about the future. But we knew that it was good. And let me just tell you the quick story about how that happened. I mean, this was literally before the channel launched. And our head writer, a guy named Eddie Gorodetsky, who's still writing sitcoms today, very funny guy, said, and he was in, we were all kids then. He was in his 20s, mid-20s, I think. Anyway, he says, hey, he talked like that because he smoked a lot of cigarettes. Hey, we really need a show where comedians talk back to the movie or the television and make funny jokes because that's what we like to do. And so we started designing that show and Eddie was working on it. And then literally in the mail, like a week later, this cassette comes in those cassette days, and we throw the thing in, and it's Mystery Science Theater 3000, and it's Joel and his two puppets, Joel Hodgson, talking to these bad movies. And by the way, originally it wasn't talking to bad movies. They did The Godfather. It was a riot. But the thing is, of course, you couldn't do The Godfather because you couldn't get the rights to do that. That would be sacrilegious. Mm-hmm. So that's how we ended up doing really bad movies. And I mean, talk about the right time at the right place. I mean, just literally we're looking for that show and there it is. And that was a great, great moment for us.
Oh, that's terrific. That is so cool. Like I'm just getting like chills, like knowing about that. Cause I remember my father telling me about that. It was just like, I was just starting to get into it and everything, but he was mentioning, it was just like, you got to watch Mystery Science Theater 3000. And then I watched, I'll never forget it. I'm at his girlfriend's house at the time. And I taped like a whole bunch of Comedy Central just to kind of like bring back with me so I can really get into it. And sure enough, an episode of Mystery Science Theater plays and it's Cave Dwellers. And was I in love with that show ever since. Like
that was great.
You never forget your first episode of MST3K, the one that made you like a fan, because it had to have been the first one. And then sure enough, like years later, that's when I discovered the crown jewel, Manos, the Hands of Fate. Like that's, and the great thing is like everyone's got their favorite. And it sounds like you definitely hit on a really good idea with this, because as it always is, like imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. All of a sudden you have a competitor, a brief competitor, but you got one.
Yeah, that changed all of our lives. What happened is we announced Comedy Channel, as we were calling it then, and a big breakfast in Los Angeles. And the chairman of HBO got up there and said, this is going to be fabulous. This is going to be the funniest thing you ever saw. I was like actually sitting there saying, listen, let's not overpromise. Anyway, and I was nervous because this thing it was me at that point. I suggested it. They bought it and not purchased it. I mean, they bought the idea and I felt responsible for the success of the thing, even though it was going to be hundreds and hundreds of people working on it. But anyway, the next day I'm flying home from Los Angeles and there's an announcement from MTV Networks basically saying, yeah, it's a press release. Yeah. We're doing a Comedy Network too. And we're calling it the Comedy Network or something. Anyway, Ha was our competition. Mm-hmm. I learned later that they showed up because we showed up. They said, oh man, if this thing works for them and we didn't do anything about it, we're going to feel bad. Mm-hmm. That's why they did it.
And it almost seems like it became like, huh? Like,
Yeah, it's hard to make a channel. And just for people who don't know the history of what happened, you're right. We only competed for a very short period of time because the head of MTV Network and the head of HBO decided, actually it was the head of Viacom, who owned MTV Network. What they decided was we were killing each other. These two channels were competing with the same audience. We were competing for the same comedians and comic shows and talent. And we were just basically killing each other. And they said, okay, we're just going to merge them. And that was, to me at the time, that was a horrendous disappointment. Really? Really? Because first of all, it's great to have competition.
Yeah.
Everybody out there knows that when you have competition, that really kind of gets you charged up. Win, lose, or draw. You're just like, you're in it. Secondly, I thought we were winning. So it's like, hey, wait a second. We're folding our hand at this point. We're winning. We're the better channel. And they said, nah, we're just going to merge them. And the interesting part, and this is why I didn't want to trash them so much, is because they had me and the head of programming, a guy named Mike Klinghoffer. They said, you guys are going to figure out what this new merge channel is all about. So have at it. Figure it out. You got a few weeks to do this. And by the way, you can't call it Ha and you can't call it the comedy channel. So your first job is to rename the thing. And that was, talk about a tremendous disappointment. You got the weather channel, you got the news channel, you got the sports channel, you got all this. What are you going to call the comedy channel? You're going to call it the comedy channel, right?
Right.
And that worked great for me. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't call it the comedy channel. So we had to come up with another name. And that's a story in itself. Again, I don't want to tell every story in the book.
Well, of course not. Yeah.
Because that would be, it would make this a 27-hour
show. I'm excited to read the book. Like, I mean, I was already excited. You already got me as a customer. So like, I am just super excited to dive into it anyway. Like now knowing about like all the different stuff that's coming on with it, I was like, oh, this is bonus. Like, bring it on. I'm a sucker for those sort of stories, like behind the scenes stuff about film and television and how things came to be. And it's wonderful. Even my dog is agreeing with me. I am just so giddy, like hearing about all of this. There were definitely some hits during that beginning. And as channels do, like there are some shows that hit, some shows that didn't. Were there some that were surprises to you in terms of like this one just maybe like a filler one, but it winds up being like a huge hit or the opposite?
Well, that's a good question. I think that nothing really surprised me from the point of view of we put it on and didn't think it would work, because you don't put it on if you don't think it's going to work.
Right.
Bill Maher is someone we put on very early on.
Politically incorrect. Right?
Politically incorrect. And again, we had the highest hopes for it. But let me tell you, the first 6 months were a disaster. It wasn't working. It wasn't coming together. Bill wasn't. Listen, it's a new show. And he didn't know exactly what it was. The writers and producers didn't know exactly what it was. And so it took time. And I will say one of the reasons I wrote the book, and you'll see this reflected in it, the first 6 months to a year of the channel wasn't working. I mean, we were just really – I went to work every day thinking I was going to be fired and they were going to shut us down. That's how bad things were. We were getting reviews, channel's not funny. It's like this is a disaster. HBO's folly, they called it. I mean, it was just – I wanted to make that point because people – and maybe you're one of them – people – now assume, hey, Comedy Central, it's always been there. It's a great channel. No, a lot of people had to work very hard to keep it from dying in the first year. And I do mean that literally. It was dying. And the chairman of HBO almost closed it down. Almost closed it down. So anyway, that was a slight digression, but an important point. Bill Maher, again, that show ultimately did come together. And of course, he's done essentially the same show for whatever that is, 40 years.
It's been quite a while. Like because Politically Incorrect stuck around until like around 2001, 2002, I think. And then it was.
Yes. And then it went to ABC, I believe.
That's right. During that time. Yeah. It was over on ABC for a while. And then it left from there around like, I think, 01, 02. And then it got picked up by HBO, I believe.
Right. HBO kind of saved its life.
Yeah.
Bill got in a lot of trouble at ABC.
Yes.
by saying something positive about the people who I'm not laughing because it's funny, but about the guys who engineered the World Center disaster, 9/11. Yeah. And that was not well received by the ABC executives. And again, the difference there, they and Comedy Central was in the same boat. They were advertiser supported. Mm-hmm. The advertisers call and the programming execs have to say, look, this isn't going to work. HBO, no advertising. They saved his life. And then we're all grateful. John Stewart, who started on a show called Short Attention Span Theater, which you may or may not remember. That show was on day one at Comedy Channel. And I remember watching him thinking, man, this guy is a star. Yeah. There's no keeping him down. He's great on television. Now, remember, he was just a baby comic in those days. He'd been on television, but he hadn't had a lot of exposure yet. And we knew he was going to be great. So The Daily Show, we knew that was going to be something. And South Park, when that rolled in the door, we figured, all right, well, if we have the guts to put this on the air. Of course, we did have the guts to put it on the air, luckily.
Talk about a staple in college. I mean, that was life-changing. Like during that came on right before my senior year in college. When I got there, it was right before I moved into my dorm. That was when I saw the pilot episode, Cartman Gets an Anal Probe. And I just remember, like, I am so in for this. I'm so in. And sure enough, it became something that not only I was really into, but so many other people that I was going to college with. We would all like file into one of our friends' dorm rooms. So there would be like about 10 of us or something like that, just like sitting there and just losing it, like on watching it. It was fantastic. It was always something that was so much fun.
Yeah, it's a great story about how that showed up. The guys did, as a kind of an entree into television, because they hadn't had anything on the air, they did a Christmas card with the
Spirit
characters.
Of Christmas.
And they sent that around, and MTV wanted it in the worst way. MTV really wanted the show. And luckily, they came with Comedy Central. But that was quite a moment in television, I got to say.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Because our ad sales guy, a guy named Larry Divney, who ultimately became president of the channel for a while, and a great guy. He was the one who said, listen, you guys put this on the air, I'll sell it. But Larry had the foresight and the wisdom to see that it was going to be great. So
wonderful. That's just another example of how much joy this channel has brought me and brought millions of other people. And once, was there like some sort of event or something that just made you say, like, I think I've done what I need to do here. Now I'm ready to move on? Or was it something that was
a different venture
you wanted to take on?
No, I mean, not so much. But there was an event that, remember I said we talked about being the center of the comedy universe and achieving that goal. And there was a moment when I thought we pulled that off. And that was when we did what we call the State of the Union Undressed. And we had comedians talking over, not unlike Mystery Science Theater, same concept, talking over the State of the Union address. And we didn't do that forever, but we did it for several years. Mm-hmm. And the first time we did it, it was, wait for it, Al Franken was the comedian who was doing this live.
Wow.
And it was the first time that I felt the press and the audience really kind of look up. I mean, they knew we were there and they were kind of watching what we were doing and stuff, but they kind of look up and say, wait a second, these guys just did something really wild. And it kind of worked, really kind of forging some new ground in comedy. And this is important. And that was a big moment for me.
And not only that, but I mean, just to have someone like Al Franken, someone obviously serving in the Senate, but before that, I mean, the man had just had decades upon decades of political insight that he was able to put into use in so many different ways. Like that
We thought he was perfect for it. It was one of those things too, where it was like, oh man, if only we could get Al Franken, but we can't.
Right.
And our head of talent said, I'll get Al Franken.
Nice.
Lori Zach, mm-hmm. she could do anything. So a week later, she comes in, we got Al Franken. It's like, are you kidding me? You know, it was just watching these things come together was sometimes so energizing and so magical. I guess that's the only word for it, magical. Yeah.
It really is. And I just like I said, I owe you a huge, huge debt of gratitude for everything that you did for that and your team. Like, everyone was just playing such a great part in bringing so much joy and so much humor into my life, into so many other people's lives.
Yes. Well, you're welcome. And you did make the point that I would make, which is there were hundreds and hundreds of people working on it initially, and ultimately thousands and thousands. So it wasn't just me at the time, ultimately, and it wasn't certainly, it's great to look in the rearview mirror and see that the channel thrived.
Yeah. And continues to do so. So what was the contrast between doing everything that you were doing for Comedy Central and also working with Court TV? Right? It's quite the turn right there. When you say.
Yeah. Well, if you read the book, you'll see I wasn't happy about leaving comedy. It was not a great ending for me. But I almost, not almost immediately, it took a little while, but I did find this new job at Court TV. And yes, the big question on everybody's lips at the time was, are you kidding me? You're going from comedy to what? Court? Criminal justice? We don't even understand that. But as I pointed out at the time, listen, I said, look, I started in economics. Nobody figured I was going to go into television. The world is an interesting, more interesting place if you keep changing gears. You don't want to necessarily, and I certainly did not want to necessarily do the same thing over and over all my life. And I thought this could be interesting. And let me tell you something. I was fascinated. The criminal justice system, and this leads directly to my work writing What She's Hiding and hopefully thrillers to come, is a very interesting place. And it's populated by people who really care. Not unlike comedians who really care about their craft, but I work with detectives, forensic scientists, police officers, certainly lawyers, judges, people who explored the criminal mind. I mean, it was a playground for me. It was just so much fun to be there. Now, of course, when I took the job, I had no idea it would be that much fun, especially since the channel was dying when I went in there. They were showing courtroom trials all day live, and then they'd repeat them all night. And guess what? That wasn't really kind of pulling, especially at night when the audience shows up. The audience wasn't looking for that. So we had to put in what ultimately became a prime time full of true crime documentaries and true crime like Forensic Files, which was a big hit for us, about how forensics solves cases and about how science comes in to really kind of save the day. So we put an entirely new prime time in place, and guess what? It worked. The mystery, meaning what's going to happen, is really the basis for so much storytelling. It's not just in mysteries. I mean, you'll see any play on Broadway or elsewhere. There's a secret waiting to be had. What's going to come out of all this? What's driving all this behavior? So those secrets and those mysteries and those certainly crime stories are fascinating to people for lots and lots of reasons. It was at Court TV, and I really think that helped me write my first mystery thriller, What She's Hiding.
And all of this, I mean, really just kind of taking all of your various experiences, working, even going into economics and then being the executive for Comedy Central and then Court TV and your own writing and everything. It seems like there is a constant question, what's going to happen next? And I'm fascinated by that because like there are so many different people are always kind of looking to kind of pare down like everything that they're doing into either like a simple term or a simple phrase or whatever. And it sounds like for you, what's going to happen next? And I'm excited to see what's going to happen next with everything you've done, but there's still so much more to go.
Oh, thanks. I'm looking forward to it too. You bring up an interesting point. People do hone their expertise so that they're like, okay, I am good at X.
Yeah.
And they spend their entire career in life. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. I wasn't built for that. I was always fascinated with the world and always had a good deal of faith in my ability and like to try things. And I will continue to do so. I hope the next thing that happens is the sequel to What She's Hiding, because so many people have read it and so many of the reviews actually said, wow, we love these characters. We want to see what happens next. I hope there's a sequel.
There you go.
And then my publisher said, please write the sequel.
Nice. So, that's when you got something. When the publisher is saying, do it. It's not because like if they would have been just like, well, why don't you try this instead? That just means that whatever happened beforehand didn't hit the way that they wanted to. But the fact that they're already saying, write the next one.
They've given me that challenge. So there I am working on that.
And you're meeting that challenge. I'm excited to see it happen. So for those that are really kind of starting out in their own field of choice, is there like one sort of tip that you would give them to kind of get them on the right path to what it is that they're doing?
Well, there's a lot of talk about following your passion. And I realize that that is not always available. I mean, we all have lots of passions that aren't going to make us a living. And making a living is part of what we have to do. I think that I said this the other day. If you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with, which I didn't write, but it's a really interesting sentiment. And what I take from that is whatever you're doing, find a way to get interested in it. And again, when I went to Court TV, people said, are you crazy? I mean, you've been in the comedy business. But I really wanted to find a way to get interested in it. And I did. So whatever you're doing, do the best job you can. Find ways to get fascinated by it, and you will excel. And then the second thing is, and this is what the book is about. The book is about, Constant Comedy is about perseverance in the face of incredible odds. And that's a lesson everybody should understand, that it really does pay off.
Absolutely. And where can my listeners find you on social media?
Social media. Yes, I am on Instagram and I am on Facebook, and that's Art Bell Author. So people can find me there. If you read my book, any of them, and like them, please leave a review for on Amazon for a couple of reasons. One, I like to hear from you, and that's a good way for me to hear from you. The second thing I'll say is I do book clubs. I love doing book clubs. So anybody out there who wants me to do a virtual book club, join their book club. I am available. Go to my website. I've got reader's guide there for the book, and I'm happy to talk about it.
Excellent. Excellent. And I really hope that a lot of you really take what Art is offering and get, again, magic of editing. Okay. All right. So I surely hope that so many of you who are listening really take advantage of what Art is offering here. He has his books. He has the availability. He is able to speak at book clubs. He is able to get the message out. And the big thing that he is embodying really with everything that he has done is what's going to happen next. And I know I'm thrilled to see what's going to happen next. And I hope that all of you are excited to find out what's going to happen next for yourself. And just like what Art was saying before, find a way to love what it is that you do. If you have that passion, if you have that love for just at least part of what it is that you are doing, whether it's your full-time job, whether it is your labor of love, whatever it is, just hold on to that passion. Hold on to the reason why you fell in love with what it is that you're doing. And keep pushing through. And eventually, once you are in that groove, in that rhythm, then you're going to be asking yourself, what's going to happen next? And that is what Art has been doing. That is what I hope all of you are doing. And as I have said many times before, in these crazy times, we need your voices and your stories now more than ever. So for Art Bell, this is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward. And I will see you next week.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Excelsior Journeys. I hope it was both inspiring and entertaining. Special thanks to Zach Comtois for providing new music for the intro and outro. Please take a moment to leave a rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe to your platform of choice by going to hesgotit.com/podcasts. While there, you can also fill out the application to be a guest, inquire about sponsorship opportunities, and click on the Buy Me a Coffee link if you wish to give your support to the show. All interaction is very much appreciated. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for the show, please direct it to George@hesgotit.com.